if you've got two islands, one of them is just filled with textbooks on musical academia, anything to do with harmony and theory, but that's it. There's no recordings there. It's just books. On the other island, hasn't got any textbooks at all, and all it has are just, you know, loads of CDs or whatever of every type of music, of every genre of music. And then you had the choice of being the best musician you could be, the most accomplished musician. Which island would you pick?
That was the voice of today's guest, Dave Swift. Dave is an amazing guy who has played with a ton of people you're definitely going to have heard of. Not least Adele, Amy Winehouse, Chaka Khan, Paul Simon, B.B. King, Paul McCartney, George Benson, to name a few. It's crazy stuff. He's featured on about 7 double platinum selling albums. He's a special guy. For the last 3 decades, Dave's been the main bass man for Jules Holland. In this interview, we hear, of course, about how Dave started out. We hear about his journey to becoming a well-rounded musician, his early years with Jules, and kind of all the experiences he's had with that band. We also talk a lot about education. Dave has some really interesting thoughts on this because he's someone who, despite being incredibly successful, hasn't had a traditional one. So we talk about that a lot. Above all, there's kind of one quote or message that I personally took away from the podcast, and it's directly hinted at the excerpt at the beginning of this podcast. Often in the study of music, whether through education or not, we can all too easily become kind of quite academic about it because we're just trying too hard. And really, this ends up just working against us. In this amazing interview, Dave reminds us how important it is to really just go to the source with music. In other words, don't study things around music, chords, books. Well, to an extent, you need to do that sort of thing. What he says is to go straight to the source, transcribe, assimilate, and then just go and do your own thing. It's amazingly and deceptively simple advice. I was inspired by this interview, and I hope you will be too. Dave's a great man with a wonderful approach to life. And it's quite a long interview, actually, but, you know, I hope you can stick through it as there's plenty of gems in there. As always, get in touch if you're enjoying the podcast, and we'd love to hear from you for whatever reason, whether it's just to say hi or something else. All right, here's the interview. So, Dave Swift, thank you so much for coming on the Lean Musician podcast, episode number 4. It's great to have you. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. And it's my pleasure to be here.
Well, I saw you just the other day at Tom's wedding, which was quite a day, actually. So not long since I last saw you. But what are you up to today? You're just chilling out at home?
I've got a couple of days off now before I go back out on tour with Jules. So we've been touring all summer and we've just had a few days off. So we've still got a couple more weeks to go. So
great. Where's the tour?
It's all UK based. A lot of the gigs we do, they're the same gigs we do every year. So in the summer we do a lot of outdoor gigs. I think this week. Actually, I'm not really sure. I think we're playing in the West Country quite soon. It's the length and breadth of the country where we tour. We do do some work abroad. We do a lot of work in Europe, and we've done a couple of world tours in the past. Mm-hmm. But we don't tend to do too many of those because of Jules' TV and radio shows. We have to be in the country.
Sure.
You know, we can't go away for too long because the TV or the radio show always crops up. Most of our work's in the UK.
Great, good stuff. Well, I mean, like you say, you just mentioned Jules there, which has been a big thing in your musical life. But I'd love to go right back to the starts, traditionally what I do and what lots of people do on their podcasts, to kind of ask you about your start in music. You know, how old were you? How did it happen? And what were the first few years like?
Sure. Well, it's interesting because people often say to me, do you come from a musical family, a musical background? And I always used to say, well, not really, because neither one of my parents played a musical instrument. And usually that's, that's what the situation is with a musical family. It starts with the parents. But my two brothers played guitar. They both played acoustic guitar at home, and there was a piano in the house that my eldest brother would occasionally play. So they were the musicians there. My parents, not at all. But I remember music being played a great deal in the house. So my two older brothers, they're 8 and 11 years older than I am. So, you know, they had records by like Jimi Hendrix and Cream and Joni Mitchell. That kind of thing. But my parents, my dad, for some reason, was a big fan of operatic music, which is kind of odd because mom and dad were working class people. They both worked in factories. So I'm not quite sure where his love of opera came from. But, you know, that's what he had albums of. But then we had things in between that, stuff like, I remember we had some Peggy Lee albums. There was like, I always remember we had the soundtrack to The Sound of Music. That got played a lot. and stuff like Glenn Miller was being played. So, you know, between my mom and my dad and my brothers, the stuff they were playing on records, there was it covered a lot of ground, a lot of different musical genres that I was listening to from day one. But, you know, I really enjoyed music. I mean, I really loved it. I loved listening to it. It was great fun. It was very pleasurable. You know, in fact, the first film I ever saw at the cinema was The Sound of Music. My mum took me to see it, and to this day, it's still one of my favourite sort of films, and I love the music from it. But again, I never thought to myself that I wanted to be a musician. It never entered my head that was a possibility. So I used
That's
to sit.
That's really interesting.
Well, yeah, I think it's because of, again, my family background. I think had I had parents that had a bit more of a bohemian lifestyle. Or that played an instrument themselves. So I could actually see someone that was earning a living from it, you know, that it was possible to have it as a lifestyle. But I didn't see any of that, so I couldn't imagine it myself. But I was very passionate about it. And also I had a good singing voice. So my own early sort of memories were singing in the school choir. I always got picked to sing in the school choir, which, again, I enjoyed immensely. And then I also joined my local church choir when I was about 10 years of age, and I stayed in the choir for about 8 years. And I just loved it. It was less to do with the religious experience, I have to say, but definitely, you know, singing, the music stuff I absolutely adored.
Fantastic. Yeah.
So that was way before playing an instrument. It's odd because seeing my brothers play the guitar, you think as a little kid that you'd immediately want to play that. And although I kind of fooled around on the instruments and even plonked around on the house piano, it still didn't jump out at me. It wasn't sort of saying, you know, play me, you know, I want you to be a musician. It still that didn't happen for a while after that. So I guess going on to actually playing an instrument.
Yeah, please.
Well, when I went to secondary school, I just went to just a regular comprehensive school, and I really fancied playing the saxophone because I think I'd seen people playing it on Top of the Pops, and I'd probably seen a few MGM musicals as a kid where someone was playing a sax, and to me it looked such a cool instrument. It just looked really sort of flashy and very kind of cool and trendy. And because I'd been listening to some jazz as well, and I knew that the saxophone was quite a predominant instrument in that genre of music. So anyway, we went to one of these open evenings at the school where the sixth formers were playing instruments, and you go there with your parents and you get to choose an instrument of your choice. So I'm thinking saxophone, has to be the saxophone. And we got there and everyone was playing flutes and oboes and clarinets, none of which I had any interest in whatsoever, because that's not the instrument. They're not the instruments that I'd seen being played on Top of the Pops.
Sure. Yeah.
So anyway, I asked the teachers and they said, no, we don't have a saxophone, I'm afraid. And I thought, okay. So next thing, I saw a trombone lying in its case. And I've always been a great big fan of the bizarre and the absurd. And for me, seeing this trombone, it did seem a really absurd instrument to me, because everything else I'd seen had sort of buttons and keys. The trombone had this slide. So I thought to myself, okay, I'm going to give that a go. And then the next time I went down to the music block a few days later, they gave me a euphonium. And I'm thinking to myself, hang on a minute, what's gone on here? You know, and they said, well, the trombone's been given to another boy. This is all we've got left. And I didn't really want it because it was so far removed from the saxophone. I'm thinking to myself, the saxophone, the coolest instrument ever, to the euphonium. as beautiful sounding as it is, I thought to myself, how am I ever going to get a girlfriend if I'm playing the euphonium?
So is that why you eventually went to the bass? Because bassists, we all know.
Well, you know, I think actually the bass found me. Yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, the thing is, I played the euphonium for a few months. I gave up on it because it wasn't my thing. And I forgot all about music. And this is kind of quite a key point because... after that, so this was in the first year of senior school, so I then just decided that music wasn't for me. If wow. I'd have been given the instrument of my choice, it may have changed everything. So what happened is that I didn't study music as an academic subject. You know, when you get to sort of choose your options later on. And again, I went back to my original thought of, you know, look at what my parents did for a living. How am I going to get a job? You know, so all the things that I enjoyed, which was very creative things like art and music and drama, I didn't bother with any of that because I thought, how on earth is that going to get me a job? I just wasn't getting, I guess, enough advice to people. So I picked a whole load of other subjects that, thinking about it afterwards, I hated every single one of them. Woodwork, metalwork, physics, biology. It's like crazy. So anyway, when I was 14, my friend who got the trombone in the first place, he'd been playing this whole time. And I'd said to him, well, what's it like? He said, it's great fun. And you get to miss an academic lesson each week. And as it turned out, the trombone teacher came on a Thursday afternoon when I had double physics. So I realised by taking up the trombone, I could actually miss a lesson in physics every week, which for me was a result.
Result.
So one of the reasons why I'm sitting here chatting to you now is more to do with my hatred of physics than it is to do with my love of music. So sure enough, I went along to this trombone teacher and I said, listen, I thought about playing this years ago. It didn't work out. I'd like to give it another go. And he said, I'm sorry, I can't take you on. I said, why have I not? He said, because you're too old. At 14 years of age, I was already
past it.
So I said to him, please, no, you know, give me the opportunity because I really want to do this. I'm thinking, I really want to skive off physics. So anyway, he gave me the trombone and he gave me Tune a Day Book 1. I remember it quite distinctly. And he said, take it home, play for a couple of weeks, see what happens. And do you know what? The planets aligned, everything came together. For some reason, myself and the trombone bonded so beautifully. And I just loved it. I absolutely loved it. And then because I found something that I was good at, because the only other thing I was good at school was sports. I was a very good athlete. And I thought if I was going to do anything when I left school, it was going to be sports related. I didn't dream of anything musical. So all of a sudden, I'm playing this trombone and I'm loving every second of it. I can't put the thing down. And I made progress very quickly. But then as far as bass goes, the school band that I played in, just decided it needed... and actually, that's not entirely true. Myself and some friends, we formed an offshoot of the school band, and we needed a bass player. So I basically, out of the blue, volunteered because I played my brother's guitars a little bit. So I was the only person that had any experience with a guitar. So I went out with my eldest brother, and we bought my first bass guitar. So this was when I was about 15. And then I started to play that. Well, I could already read music now from playing the trombone. Again, I wasn't taking music as an academic subject. So I was learning everything from my trombone lessons at school with this peripatetic teacher. And so all I then had to do was to transfer all my knowledge from the trombone and from reading music onto the bass, which is what I did. So I started to play bass guitar, and then my trombone teacher, which is one of the best pieces of advice I've ever been given, said to me, you know, you should consider taking up acoustic bass, double bass, because if you decide to do this for a living and you are already good enough to do this, then playing the double bass as well as the bass guitar will mean you'll get a lot more work. And so that's basically what I did. So while I was still at school, I was playing trombone, bass guitar, and double bass, and enjoying every second of it.
Fantastic. And was it something, would you recommend that then to anyone who's starting out to actually play numerous instruments? And to a certain extent, it sounds like you came from the so-called classical tradition, the reading side using trombone, and you brought that to your bass playing, which went in a different direction. Would you recommend that to to people?
Well, do you know what? I think it all depends on what you're hoping to do. You see, for me, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just knew that I was loving playing these instruments. I wasn't thinking about doing it for a living.
Sure.
And in some ways, I'm glad that I was a classically trained trombone player, because, like I said, at that time, a lot of bass players, they couldn't read. There were only like a few bass players, because I'm originally from the West Midlands. I'm from Wolverhampton. And there was the theatres there, so the theatre guys could read, but all the other guys that were doing just regular gigs, there were very few bass players that could read. So that's the reason why my trombone teacher said, this will be good for you, because it means straight away I can get you work in shows, in sessions, and stuff like that. Because if I'd have just joined a band, you know, those things take time to grow and develop and to build up a following and whatever. But back then, if you could read music, you could immediately get work. So I'm kind of glad that I did it, because a lot of my early years depended on my ability to sight read. But if I was giving advice to younger people now, it's trickier, because, for instance, in the Jules Holland Band, there's only myself and the horn section that can read written notation. The rest of the rhythm section, fine players as they are, don't really read music. You know, but the thing is, we've all ended up, and some of the horn players, they went to university, they got degrees. I didn't do that at all. I left school at 16, and that was it. I turned pro straight away. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is that music's a great leveler. So you look at the Jules Holland Band, it's a 20-piece band that's hugely successful. We're playing with incredible, high-profile, iconic artists on a regular basis. But the mixture of people in the band, our musical background is so varied. But we've all ended up in the same place. We're all playing the same music with the same people. Yet some people read music, some people don't. Some people had a music education, some others didn't. So it's incredible.
Yeah. Well, there's many, many paths to.
Yeah, but I would say, you know, if you really wanted to, say, particularly play in a West End show, then you've got no other choice, but you need to read music. There's no other way around it. You can't do it otherwise. But if you just want to play in bands, or you just want to kind of jam, or even sort of, you know, just to do like freelance jazz gigs, then there's not that great a need to learn to read music.
Yeah. So early on, it sounded like that your kind of early skill set gave you the ability to be, well, really exposed to a ton of different input, you know, a ton of different musicians doing these sessions, as you said. So like in the first sort of 3-4 years, before Jules and stuff like that, what were the kind of things that you were doing? And I mean, how many people were you playing with a month and things like that?
Well, the thing is, because I was still playing trombone as well. So,
yeah.
I mean, just with the trombone alone, I mean, I was playing in orchestras. I played in several brass bands. I was playing in, you know, sort of jazz orchestras. I was playing small groups. I even played in a funk band that were doing Earth, Wind & Fire kind of stuff. So I was playing in a small horn section. So even before I took up the bass, I'd pretty much played every musical genre you could imagine. So that's the reason why it was easy for me when I switched to bass, because I'd already had a great deal of experience with all of these types of music. But a lot of them were just, you know, they were kind of rehearsal things. You know, they weren't necessarily fully pro things. Some of them were, but a lot of what I did early on were things like shows. It was pit work, I guess you'd call it. But, you know, things like TV sessions and radio jingles. But everything I was doing had written music. And this is one of the problems that I had early on. This is the only thing that I guess that I have any regrets about very early on, because I wasn't playing much music just by ear. Almost everything I was doing was written down and placed in front of me. So the great thing is there was nothing on the bass that I couldn't play, because the complexity of the music on the trombone had already prepared me for that. So everything I was playing on the bass was so simple. But again, the problem was playing without music. And it's the one thing I always had a bit of a fear and dread of, because I just knew that it was the weakest part of my playing. And it took me a long time to get around that.
So when did you first start encountering that as a kind of so-called difficulty in your playing?
I suppose it was kind of like late teens, when I got to about sort of 19 or 20, I was playing in a big band, again, that had a huge pad of music, fantastic charts, like kind of Buddy Rich kind of stuff, and Duke Ellington, Count Basie, all these things. And a lot of it was written down. But then at one point during the concert that I was in this regular band, there was like a small group of it, like a splinter group, would sort of come out the front and do like a Dixieland tune or like a jazz standard. And I remember the trumpet player at the time, he called me out, and he just sort of said, whatever the name of the song was in the key, and I'm looking at him kind of going, what? You know, where's the music? Where, at least a chord chart. And it wasn't. And I realized then that, you know, you need to have a repertoire of songs as well as a working musician, especially, you know, if you're playing sort of jazz, big band stuff. And basically, I was one of the youngest guys in the band. These guys were much older than me. So they knew all of these jazz standards, and they'd been playing them by ear a lot. And I hadn't been. And I was horrified.
So what, I'm interested what you did at that point then, sort of that kind of juncture. What did you go and do?
Well, I definitely started. He was my problem. I think I wasn't listening to enough music. I was practicing a great deal. And back then, I used to focus an awful lot on technique. I became very obsessed with technique. And I wasn't spending enough time developing my ear. That was my problem. I wasn't listening to stuff, and I wasn't analysing things. I was listening to things in a very, very casual way. But also, here's the thing. I didn't know about harmony either. I'd never studied it, because playing the trombone, you know, it's. I'd never played the piano, for instance, or the guitar, so I'd never studied harmony. I didn't know enough about it. And I remember one of the things I did at one of my earliest gigs was working on the QE2, the Queen Elizabeth II cruise liner. And I did this in 1984, I was 20. And I was on the cruise ship with just a dance band playing sort of background music. But one of the saxophone players, he's a very prominent UK-based player. His name's Julian Arguilles.
Oh, yeah.
And he was in the band I was in. And I love spending time with him, because this was someone who was a really dedicated jazz musician and was just doing this gig to earn a bit of cash. But he knew way more about jazz and improvisation than I did. So we used to go to New York on a regular basis, and we'd always go to Manny's, and we bought our first fake books there. You know, the books with all the chord charts and all of that. And they were called fake books then. And actually, they were still illegal. So when you went into a music shop, I think it was Manny's or something like that, we had to buy them in a brown paper bag. And they had to be served underneath the counter. But, you know, he said to me, if you want to learn to play jazz and jazz standards, this book will be a big help. But I also remember buying a load of those Jamie Abersole books, because it's the first time I'd ever seen books on improvisation, because I hadn't seen anything like this before. So I bought a couple of those, thinking this was going to be the answer to all my prayers. But actually, I realized quite quickly on that just what I needed to do is just spend more time listening to tunes. And to some extent, you know, you have to throw yourself in the deep end. So that occasion when I got called down to play a jazz standard, I didn't know it. It was the best thing you could do. But then I learned, my ears got better. As time went on, I started to play with more people where there wasn't any written music. But it was a slow process. It took me a long time to break the habit of requesting written parts and chord charts. It wasn't an easy transition, let's put it that way.
Right, yeah. No, that's fascinating, especially about the Prohibition Real Book stuff. It's hilarious.
But, you know, one of my friends said to me years later, you know, he sort of said, it's really important. A lot of musicians these days, younger guys, they're so obsessed with practicing, and often not practicing the right things, you know, just technique or speed or whatever. And he did say to me, I said, well, what advice can you give me? And he said to me, listen more than you play. And I thought he had a good point, because, you know, so I was working out of these real books and fake books, but the thing is, I wasn't listening to the recordings, you know, and I wish, you know, what you need to do is just to go to the source in those circumstances, because there's only certain information you've got on that page. And actually, a lot of those chords in those early books were incorrect. So, you know, you weren't getting the correct information. But he said to me, just listen more, you know, so I made sure then that my record collection grew, I spent a lot of time tracking down records and just spending more time listening to stuff and playing along with them.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask about that because I often think it's really important to think, well, to listen actively as well, because you can listen very passively to stuff, which is also good. There are different ways you can listen. So, I mean, when you were listening, were you, in effect, sort of transcribing in your head? You were jamming along with it, or was it kind of just absorbing?
Well, to be honest, it was all of the above, because I remember the first time I ever heard Jaco Pastorius, you know, the fantastic American sort of bass guitarist, the virtuoso guy, and it was someone lent me a weather report. While I was playing the trombone in orchestral practice, somebody said, well, you know, you've learned to play the bass, so you need to listen to this guy, and it was a weather report album called Night Passage. And I'd never heard of weather report, and I'd never heard of Jaco Pastorius. I took this record home, and it did blow my mind, I have to say. But it also made me panic, because I thought to myself, am I expected to play like this guy on every gig? Because, you know, I'd just started out on the bass, and this guy was a complete virtuoso, and I did panic to begin with. But I really loved the music, and I definitely loved his technical prowess. And so I started to, that's when I started to transcribe stuff. I started to transcribe a lot of Jaco Pastorius kind of bass lines. But obviously I knew that was more for my own pleasure, because a lot of the time I knew I wasn't going to be able to get to play those bass lines on the commercial gigs that I was doing. But it was still good because it was developing my ear. It was, you know, I was writing music. It was all good. I always say transcriptions are a great thing. I still do them all the time. And they're very hard work. I mean, they're terribly hard work, and they're very time consuming. But I always say about transcriptions, the hard work is its own reward. Because I've learned more from transcribing bass lines, melodies, solos. I've learned more from doing that than from any theory book that I've ever encountered. You know, in other words, going straight to the source. So if you want to learn to sort of solo like Miles Davis, as opposed to buying a book on how to solo like Miles Davis, no, go and buy some Miles Davis albums and listen and practice and transcribe and play along with.
Yeah, completely. I mean, for me, the two things that whenever I'm trying to, you know, study something that isn't music as well, I end up writing kind of like an outline of a book on it, you know, some big topic. I'll never publish or do anything with the book, but the idea of kind of taking the information and digesting it and pulling it in. So transcriptions are like that. For composition, pastiche composition is something I've done for years, just for fun. And you just get to think about it. It's like, what's that thing that Tom always says? I forget who said it.
Here it goes. It's a Clark Terry quote, and it's imitate, assimilate, and innovate.
Yeah, that's it.
Exactly. I think it's attributed to Clark Terry, and you know what? That's pretty much it. Those three words just sum everything up, because the greatest jazz musicians that I particularly, because I mean, jazz is probably my favorite type of music. I mean, I get to play a lot of different stuff, but I think deep down, I really still love playing jazz and improvised creative music. I'll go further to say that. But I think that all of the guys that I really admire, the older players, the more iconic players, really didn't go to sort of music colleges to do that, to learn to play that. They basically imitated people that came before them. You know, their contemporaries. They copied, you know, like Ray Brown, the great jazz bassist. He listened to Jimmy Blanton. He got Jimmy Blanton albums and just copied everything he did. And initially, that's what he was doing. He was doing it like copying note for note. But then he then went off and did gigs, played a little few things from that, which obviously was the assimilation thing. But then eventually, hopefully, what comes out is something of your own. But I think to begin with, you have to listen to other people and you know, see what they're doing.
Yeah.
That seems to be the universal way that those guys learned to do what they did, learned to play like they did, was purely listening.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to getting too bogged down in the academia side of it. In fact, when I, not long after I moved to London, which was in 1988, I ended up studying with an American jazz bassist called Michael Moore. I'm pleased to say he's still with us, but he was living in London at the time, and he's gone back to America now. But I'd got a couple of records with him on. So when someone said he's in town and teaching, I knew that I had to go and study with him. And he was just a wonderful guy. He taught me so much. He encouraged me to switch from French bow to German bow on the double bass, which to me was much, much more natural, and I still use it to this day. But he was such a beautiful lyrical player. Play with a lot of guys, play with Bill Evans. And also, he was the last bass player with Dave Brubeck. Before Dave passed away, but Michael Moore, he told me an interesting thing, you know, to do with education, and he said he attended one of those summer jazz schools. I think it may have been a Jamie Abersold one, but he was certainly like a summer jazz school in the States, and he was just pottering in between classes, going out and looking at other people teaching, and he told me himself that he had not had much of a music education as far as jazz went. He was just more of an organic player, and anyway he was watching them on the blackboard doing things like harmonizing various minor scales, harmonizing the melodic minor scale, the harmonic minor scale, and all the modes that are generated from it. And he's standing there watching it, actually quite bewildered by all this academia. And he actually said to me, he said, I quickly realized that I had been playing that stuff naturally. I'd been doing this for years. I just didn't know what it was or what it was called. You know what I mean? So he'd already been out there performing and playing creative music and improvising, but he just didn't know, you know, all the academic terms and all the modes. But he'd been doing it naturally. He'd been doing it by ear because he'd learned from listening to other players.
Completely. Yeah. It's such a crazy thing. I mean, talking as a part-time teacher as well, it's just the double-edged sword of music education. You know, it can be great, and it can also just be, you know, terrifyingly deadening thinking in that way. And the difficult thing, it's like that theory of multiple intelligences I think of at the moment, because it's like, you know, some people naturally have an inclination to go ahead and just, like you and like him, to kind of just basically assimilate stuff, you know, just and imitate things. And yet there are some kids as well who, whether it's them or their parents or whatever, you know, are wanting to get started in an early stage and don't have a natural inclination, or they may be passionate, but they may not dive straight into the imitation side of things. So, and just balancing the kind of what do you call it, the intellectual side of music, and my main aim is to get people to be passionate and into what they're doing so that they can find their own drive, you know. And actually sometimes I say to people, listen, all you need to do is, when I've heard about their goals and what they want to achieve with music, if they're just starting out, you know, I give them a few lessons and I explain that, listen, it's not all about just coming to me and having some theory lessons and me giving you goals. It's about you taking this out there and just, you know, just copying stuff and following your nose, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing is, it's interesting when I took up the trombone, that first, straight away, the teacher didn't say to me, you know, just go home and play it and have some fun with it. Just make things up, just make a noise, do whatever you want with it for a couple of weeks, even a month, whatever. But straight away you get given a book. In my case, it was one of those Tune a Day books, and yeah, I mean, it was great, because I couldn't really read music prior to that, so it was a life changing thing. But at the same time, I did sort of feel, looking back now, it was almost like you've got these chains around you, because you're straight away you're forced into learning in a very academic kind of almost stuffy kind of way. I think now if I was sort of teaching like someone from scratch, I certainly wouldn't just tell them to go out and just get a music theory book. I'd just say, have some fun with the instrument. Have some, because I think for me, it's sort of, I could have probably been had more. You know, I could have been more of an improvising player early on had I have done that. But I kind of think, because I've been given books, I've been given music books and theory books, and every single thing I played was written down. And it's kind of great, because you're getting a music education, but I think it was stifling potentially any sort of creativity that was there initially.
Yeah, totally. So that would be the advice, would you say, that you'd give yourself if you could go back and talk to young Dave?
Yeah, absolutely. I would certainly sort of say, you know, do a lot more things that didn't involve written music. Play with other people, and but it almost became, you know, like a crutch, really, because I just knew that I could take on anything that it involved written music. But then there were certain things that I really wanted to do, but I didn't get involved with because I didn't trust my ear enough. I didn't think my ear was developed. I hadn't done enough of it. So, yeah, I'd sort of say, spend as much time sort of listening and training your ear and playing by ear, then, it took me a long, long time to balance those things out. In fact, when I got the Jules gig, it was interesting because there was no music at all. I was used to having charts there, but I realised that this wasn't going to happen in this band. So I knew that everything had to be learnt by ear, and it was fantastic for me. It really forced me into doing something that I should have been doing.
Yeah, there's a point in there that you said earlier about that famous phrase about just diving in the deep end, or it was something like that that you said. We're so often, and I think the dangerous part of education is that idea that you need to get yourself ready before you go and do it. Whereas some of the most successful people go and do it before they can do it and before they're ready. And then that somehow supercharges the process. Does that make sense?
Of course. Well, it's a bit like, yeah, with the whole jazz thing, you know, because there's so much money to be made now from academia, and especially in the jazz world, there's a lot of kind of schools and courses you can go on. And I think the problem there is it can create this school of thought where I can't go out and do a jazz gig. I can't go out and improvise with other people unless I've studied every single thing about harmony and jazz harmony there is to know. You know, it makes some people paranoid. And the thing for me is, it's a bit like when you've got like a small child. You would never say to a small child, here's a dictionary. You know, you are not allowed to sort of speak or put a sentence together unless you've learnt all the words in this book.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I suppose it's people's inhibitions, isn't it, and fear in the beginning that makes them feel like, right, I have to go and study this rather than just explore and make mistakes. You know, it's like I'd mentioned to you before the show about having William Wesley on number one, which is a great podcast, but his book is called The Perfect Wrong Note, which is essentially about what we're talking about, you know.
Yeah, sure. Well, I've seen the podcast. It's fabulous. I'd love to read the book. I mean, I definitely will, but I think it's... I think it sort of causes problems, you know, and it's just important to. I mean, some of the best lessons that I've learned have been on the bandstand. I've just been playing with other people, and you've made mistakes, and then you know you might be playing a tune you've never heard before. I mean, I do this a lot now. A lot of my freelance gigs, when I'm playing in London, I don't always know who I'm going to be playing with. And more importantly, you don't know what songs you're going to be doing. But I guess there's an expectancy that if you're doing that type of gig, that you have a repertoire. Because again, you know, when I was coming up, a lot of bands had pads of music. They had big, big pads, charts, chord charts, written things. That doesn't exist anymore. Not in the from what I've seen. It's like you're expected to have this ridiculous repertoire of music. You know, so if you go and do a gig, you need to know a certain amount of standards, a certain amount of pop tunes, certain Beatles thing. You've got to have that in your head, and that's a lot of stuff to know. That's an awful lot of pressure, especially for younger players.
Sure.
Because they've got even the longer history of music to listen to than I had when I was starting out. But yeah, I never turn up anywhere now and people say, oh, here's some chord charts, here's a written part. You've just got to, and they just start playing. Often you don't even get the title of the song or the key. You know, you've just got to play. But it's a great, a very fertile environment to be in. And of course, and if you don't know the song, you know, these people are not going to turn around and stop and then say, okay, let's do something else. They're going to carry on doing it, and you are expected to pick it up the second time around. And although it's very daunting, it's very exciting as well.
Well, I kind of want to shift gears a bit and actually talk about your kind of, let's kind of fast forward to your kind of start with Jules. How did that come about? And then I want to ask you about kind of the musical experiences, which are kind of various and incredible. So yeah, how did that first come about?
Well, prior to, I mean, I've been with Jules Holland now 25 years, but I've been a professional musician for 35 years. So for those first 10 years, I was what you would call a freelance session guy. So I was doing whatever gigs sort of came along. So I worked a lot on cruise ships, a lot of theatre work, a lot of sessions. But here's the thing, I always listened to creative music. I was always a big fan of jazz fusion, jazz funk. You know, and it was all with very, very creative guys, you know, listening to things like Return to Forever, you know, Chick Corea, Stanley Clark, Weather Report, all those type of bands. So, and I thought to myself, well, hang on a minute, I'm not doing this. This isn't, I'm playing okay music and I'm playing with good musicians, but none of it is particularly creative. So I was earning a great living, I was traveling the world, but I wanted to do that. I wanted to play more improvised creative music with creative musicians. Now, initially, interestingly enough, I moved to London in 1988. But before I moved to London, I actually wanted to go and study somewhere. I was considering Berklee, the Berklee School of Music, because it seemed to be a lot of players I admired had gone there. I sent away to the prospectus, and it was too expensive. I just couldn't afford to do it. So I thought the next best thing to do is to move to London. But I didn't know anyone here at all. I think I knew two people in the whole of London. And so this was in 1988. And I said to myself, okay, I'm only going to take on work that I really want to do. I'm not going to do all the stuff that I've done before. So I avoided the temptation to go and work in the West End, to do anything where there was written music. I just played jazz. I hardly played the bass guitar. By this stage, I'd given up on the trombone because I wasn't any good at it, but I just didn't have the time. There weren't enough hours in the day to practice that. So the trombone had to go, I'm afraid, much to my sadness. But I didn't even want to play bass guitar. I wanted to play double bass. I wanted to play jazz with jazz musicians, and that's what I did for the first couple of years of being in London. And it was wonderful because it was very creative, and I was playing the music that I really wanted to play, playing with the musicians I wanted to play. The only downside to it, I was absolutely skint. I didn't have any money at all, and it made me quickly realise what a fabulous art form playing jazz was, but what a terrible profession choice.
Yeah. I remember someone saying once about just the amount of hours that most jazz musicians put in compared to other people who put in that amount of hours, and then the equivalent money that comes out is just insane.
It just doesn't make sense at all. But my goodness, it was so rewarding. It was, I just cannot begin to tell you how happy I was. And I'd been earning less money than I had been for 10 years. I really, really kind of suffering for my art. But the rewards were so great. The music I was listening to and playing. But anyway, what happened is that I was playing with a saxophone player at the time, and he'd already got the Jules gig. And at the time, Jules, he was in a pop group called Squeeze, and he'd left and rejoined them a few times, but this was the final time, so he was going solo. Now, I didn't know a huge amount about Jules. I remember him from the TV show The Tube, which was a live music show back in the 80s that he co-hosted with Paula Yates. And I knew he was in Squeeze because I'd got a couple of their records, but I didn't know a great deal about him. But Phil said, yeah, the sax player said he's going solo, and he's already got like a rhythm section and a horn section, but he needs a bass player because the bass player, well, prior to me, it was Pino Palladino. Highly acclaimed bass player, as you know. So it was Pino's first gig when he moved to London was playing with Jules Holland. And then the next bass player was the bass player in Squeeze, but Squeeze reformed, and he went back with them, thinking that was a better choice. But it was sadly he kind of got it a bit wrong because Squeeze quickly folded after that. I mean they're back now, but at the time he just thought, well, potentially starting out with Jules as a solo career, he didn't know where it was heading, and none of us did. So basically, I got called to do an audition at Jules Holland Studio, which is here in Southeast London. And interestingly enough, I'm the only person that's ever auditioned for the Jules gig. Everybody else in that band just got it through word of mouth. They just got the gig. I'm the only one that I'm aware of that had to do an actual audition. I've never discovered the answer why that is, but I think it's a lot to do with the bass for Jules is very important. It's a crucial instrument for him, being a pianist and what he does with his left hand. So I think he needed to spend some time playing with me beforehand to see what I could do and what I was capable of doing. He didn't just want to say, oh yeah, come along to a gig, and then realize on stage that it's not happening. So yeah, this was towards the end of 1991. So I went along to Jules Holland Studio, South East London, and there was Jules and the guitarist, our guitarist, and we just played around Jules's piano. I was playing double bass because he was only really interested in the upright at that time. And we played for about an hour, and it all seemed to go well. Now, here's the thing. Again, no music, no chord charts. But by this stage, because I'd been playing with jazz musicians, I was way more confident about my ability to play by ear. Now, for instance, if I'd have got the Jules gig, say, 10 years prior to that, I would have been a lot more nervous because I didn't think my ability to just play, because I didn't know what we were going to play. He would just start to play stuff, and I just had to join in. But luckily, by this stage, I was prepared for it. And anyway, he said, okay, it's great, you sound really great, but there's a few other people we have to see. And I remember thinking, well, that sounds a bit of a brush off.
Let's go and meet the board.
Yes, exactly. So Jules and the guitarist went outside for a quick chat. And 5 minutes later, and I'm packing the bass up. But here's the interesting thing. I wasn't too fussed. I remember thinking at the time, I wasn't sort of panicking or thinking, oh, God, I hope I get it. Because here's the thing. I was already enjoying what I was doing. I wasn't earning a great deal of money, but the music I was playing and the musicians that I was currently playing with was so rewarding for me that I just thought, if Jules comes back in and says, no, it's not going to work out, I honestly wouldn't have minded at all. I know that sounds crazy now, but he came back in and said, yeah, I looked to hell with it, the gig's yours, we've got a tour in a few weeks' time, we'll get some cassettes to you so you can listen to some of the previous shows, and that was it.
Yeah. Well, it just goes to show that, I mean, that's the classic thing, isn't it? About, like, if you don't care about something, you're often going to perform a hell of a lot better.
Yeah, absolutely. I was so carefree about the whole thing. It's probably what got me through the audition. Now, say, for instance, back then, there wasn't that much to lose, because at that stage, Jules didn't have his TV show, his BBC Two later with Jules Holland TV show. He didn't have his Radio 2 show either. And we didn't have the gigs. It was just like a handful of gigs in little colleges and summer balls, whatever. You know, he's not the person, the artist that he is now. So, if you were auditioning for the Jules gig now, you'd be a lot more sort of paranoid, and you'd be a lot more keen to get it because you'd know what you were getting yourself into and stuff, and you'd be more keen to do a better job sort of thing.
I'd love to know, what did you get into then?
Well, again, when I got that gig, it was 1991. Now, here's the key point, right? We didn't know. None of us in the band knew where that gig was heading. As far as we were concerned, we were doing a few little gigs, a few private parties, and it was just fun. It was just, we were just having a laugh, and we were still all in our 20s. But then, very, very quickly, Jules' popularity went crazy. And he got that TV show. He got asked to host BBC Two's later. It was like a late night music show, and I think it was probably just called The Late Show at first, or it may have even been called Later, but now it's called Later with Jules Holland, and that started just a couple of years afterwards. So fairly quickly, all of a sudden, we're being told, you know, you're needed to play it on TV, and none of us had done this before. This was a whole new thing for us, and it was exciting and daunting all at the same time. So very early on, we were playing with ludicrously famous people, and over the years, it's just grown from that, both on the TV and the radio show. So, for instance, you know, we've been lucky enough, or I've been lucky enough to play with three of the Beatles in my time with Jules, and I've played with two of the guys in the Rolling Stones. But on top of that, you know, really iconic people like Eric Clapton and B.B. King and Jeff Beck. And the great thing with the Jules gig now is we've all got to play with some of our own musical heroes. So if you ask different people in the band, they're all going to come up with different names. But interestingly for me, the people that my favourite people were the people I grew up listening to. They were the ones whose albums that I'd bought. And I couldn't now believe that I'm actually playing with these people on TV. It's just beyond my imagination. So people like, the great singer Al Jarreau, Chaka Khan, another favourite of mine, George Benson, the great American guitarist, But much later on, people like Amy Winehouse and Adele, you know, but none of us saw this coming. This was just completely unexpected. But, you know, this was our job now. Our job was playing on live television with these really famous, iconic people, you know, sort of Paul McCartney.
Yeah, so there's like a ton of different people that you mentioned there, and they're all really varied as well. And I'm kind of interested to dig a little deeper about your experience with a number of them / all of them. Kind of, what are some of the main characteristics, or what do you think's, I suppose what I'm trying to ask is, what's been one of the kind of shared features of all of them about the great musicians that you played with?
Well, interestingly, you know, people often say to me, what have I learned most about working with these artists? And actually, from being in Jules' band, I've learned, you know, I've learned an awful lot about music and or anything related to it. But I've also learned an awful lot about human behaviour, if nothing else. And the one thing that I've noticed with a lot of these artists, and they are, you know, world famous, iconic artists and stuff. But it's interesting that sort of being, you know, in the rehearsal room behind closed doors, you know, they're not always the people that you think they are. And actually, they're often very sort of, there's a lot of humility there. There's an awful lot of humility. And it's refreshing to see, because this industry is often so ego-led these days. It's what you sort of see predominantly in the industry. But it's more to do, a lot of these people, they, you know, you don't have to be an amazing musician to be able to play with Eric Clapton. You don't have to be a virtuoso guy. I mean, not at all. I mean, you know, you have to be competent, but it's more to do with, you know, your personality, because, you know, you need to spend the whole day with these people. Even if you're only recording one or two songs on a TV or a radio show, you have to spend an awful lot of time with these people. So, you know, you have to be very personable with them. You have to not be overly friendly. You know, you can't make out as though they're your best mate and you've only just met them and they are who they are. You've got to have a certain amount of sort of decorum about you. But but yeah, you know, the one thing that I've realized, you know, you need to have a very good ear as well, because you need to learn to play songs very, very quickly when you're with these people. Unless you get given a CD or a recording of it in advance, I've had to work with these artists where you've met them on the day and you've got to learn a song right there in front of them very quickly. You know, Amy Winehouse was a good example. She came on Jules' radio show and we had to play one of the tracks off her album. Now, we knew she was coming on the show, we didn't know what track it was. So we were in the studio just prior to the actual show being recorded, and we had to learn one of her songs on the spot. So there was no time to write anything down. We just had to listen to the CD in the control room, and after two run-throughs, we had to play it with her. We had to play it on the show. And you know full well, if you turn around and you've got to say, no, I still don't know it, I've got to listen to it six more times, then, you know, that's not a good thing. That's going to be a problem. So, you know, we to be put in that environment where you're playing with these almost intimidating sort of people, because they're so famous, they're so iconic, and you've got to learn their songs. Some of that they've potentially been playing their whole lives, so they know it inside out, but you haven't heard it before. So, you know, we all had to become very good at learning stuff really quickly, because they're sitting there looking at you, waiting for you to learn it.
So nowadays, do you have like kind of practice time at all in terms of the material? I know that you work on your with transcriptions and things like that, but do you ever have practice time where it's like, hey, we've got this repertoire to learn or whatever?
Yeah, well, what happens now is, as like I said, for the radio show has been going something like 17 years. A lot of people still don't know it exists, but it has been going that time. And the first 10 years of it, I would say, we never got told what the tune was, and we had to learn it there and then on the spot. Now, although this was really daunting and really hard work, and it was a very, very pressurized situation, it was the best thing. It was one of the best experiences of my life, because it forces you to, your ears grow very, very quickly. You know, you have no choice. It's sink or swim. You can't turn around and say, I'm sorry, I haven't got the ability to do this. I need loads more time. You're done for. It's show business suicide. But so that was great. So we had 10 years of that. But then eventually the BBC started to send us the material the night before. you know, we'd get either a CD in the post or we'd get like an MP3. But again, there'd never be any music. There's never any music written down. We always have to learn it ourselves. It's the same when we do Jules' TV shows, the later and also the New Year's Eve Who's a Nanny show. I mean, the horn section get charts because somebody... There's about four or five of the horn section that take it in turns to do arrangements, but they only do arrangements for the horns. There's no parts for the rhythm section at all. Sure. And the main reason being, with all due respect to the other guys, I would be the only person that could read the charts.
So what's your approach to a new piece that's relatively, or not necessarily challenging, but relatively in-depth?
Okay, well, what I always do without fail, first thing I always do, I transcribe everything that I have to play. So, I'll get the CD, whether it's the radio show, the New Year's Eve TV show, I will transcribe the bass line note for note, 100%. And even at home here, I've got like loads and loads of these box folders with thousands of transcriptions of all of these incredible artists over the years. And it's a nice thing to have as a souvenir. But here's the thing. For me, Jules, one of the things he values about me is his attention to detail. I'm the detail guy in the rhythm section because Jules will listen to the songs probably more in a bit more casual way, a bit more organic way, so he might listen to it while he's at home or driving the car, just to get the general idea of it. Because, you know, he still wants to be able to play with some freedom, but he knows that he can do that because I will have learnt the bass part off it note for note. And in some ways, it's not a bad thing because some of the people we play for, the bass line in itself is quite iconic. It's something that you can't always just make up. It's got to be what's on the record. And so I'll always do that to begin with. So I can see every little thing the original bass player did on the album. Every little sort of, even if he makes mistakes or any little kind of nuances, I've got it written down there. And it's a great starting point. Now, when we turn up to the TV or recording studio, I'll often say to the person we're playing with, do you want me to play exactly what was on the record? And obviously, if they say yes, then I've already done the work. I've done this in my spare time. But quite often, but it's 50-50. Sometimes I say, yeah, absolutely, it's got to be like the record. And I'm thinking, well, great, well, because I'm done here. But then sometimes they'll say, no, completely play it freely. Just do whatever you want, embellish, which I'm more than happy to do. But here's the thing. If I didn't do that work in the first place, if I didn't do that very, very accurate and full transcription, and I just turned up and I'd been listening to it while I'm in the bath whistling, and they turn around to me and they say, oh, Dave, you know, have you got the exact part from the record? And I'm going to go, I didn't realise that's what you wanted. You know, then I'm kind of compromised.
Yeah. And it's also about learning the rules so that you can break them.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that. So at least if I have the transcription to begin with, that's the foundation out of the way. And anything after that is going to be easy. But if I haven't done that and I've just learned it in a very casual way and they said, no, it's got to be as the record, then I've got to go to a corner of a room and do that transcription there and then, which I won't have the time to do. But I always attempt to play without it if I can. If there's time, I will try and learn it without the music. And this is more important, say, if you do a TV show where you don't want to be seen with your head to be buried in a pile of music, because obviously TV is a much more visual thing. If we're in the radio in the recording studio doing a radio show, it doesn't really matter if I'm reading from a chart because it's only what people are going to hear. But I will make every effort to learn the music. But to me, it's just really rewarding doing the transcription because, again, you're really getting to the heart of the song. And I'll often put the chords above it as well if I have the time. But it just means to me that you're getting right to the centre of it. You're not just hearing it in a very haphazard, casual way. You've really got to the core of it, which I enjoy doing. But then after then it can free you up. They'll often say, Dave, you don't have to stick so rigidly to it, but at least I've got some, you know, like a working thing. I've got a basis to work from.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about, do you ever have any parts where you're kind of doing solos or kind of more improvisational stuff still?
To be honest with you, no, not really. The Jules gig, I mean, a lot of people often say to me, they say, Dave, how come you're not more flamboyant on the Jules gig? How come you don't do solos? And I always turn around to them and say the same thing, mainly because I don't want to get fired. Because you know the thing with the Jules gig, it's a large band, it's a 20-piece band, and there are some incredibly fine soloists in there. There's some great soloists, and really my job in that group is much more of an accompanying thing. It's holding stuff together, you know. So Jules, he doesn't really want me to be too flamboyant. In fact, for the first sort of 10 years of having that gig, at least, he would always tell me to play less. Play more simple stuff. You know, don't be so flashy. Play lower down. and I had to accept early on that that is what the job required. Now, there's a lot of people that wouldn't be able to handle that. Their ego might get in the way, and they might sort of say, no, I want to stand out, I want to show up. But then they wouldn't have the job anymore because Jules wouldn't keep them on. He would fire them. It'd have to, because that's not what the gig is about. And actually, interestingly enough, this brings me to... there's a quote. There's one of my favourite sort of bass players. In fact, he's one of my favourite musicians on the face of the earth. And he's an American bass guitarist called Anthony Jackson. He's an incredible player. He played a lot, more commercial stuff. He played with sort of Chaka Khan on a lot of her albums. But more recently, he played with Hiromi, you know, the Japanese... sort of pianist, right. And in fact, I went to see them quite recently. But he's one of my greatest inspirations, not just as a bass guitarist, but as a musician. And there's an interview that he did many, many years ago, and they talk about this sort of soloing thing and drawing attention to yourself. And if I may sort of quote from this interview, but he really kind of sums it up great. They sort of say, you know, you don't solo very much at all. And he was kind of saying, well, if it doesn't suit the piece, if it doesn't suit the music, then why would I? You know, he's thinking of it from a very intelligent musical way. He just doesn't want to do the obligatory solo. If he doesn't really feel like, if he doesn't feel as though it's necessary, he doesn't want to do it. Anyway, so what they say is, that this is the question they ask him. They say, when you do take a solo break, you don't tend to shoot up into the horn register on the bass right away like so many players do. And Anthony says this, and this is a great answer. It's a matter of maturity. You shoot into the horn register when it's appropriate. You don't do it to show you can do it, and you don't shoot up high or play 64th notes to impress the other bass players in the audience. You have to be prepared to accept that if all you get to play are whole notes in the lower middle register at low volume, you are still as much of an artist as if you get to play 64th notes all night at loud volume. It's absolutely essential that a musician be secure enough in himself to do that. And I think that's such a great quote because, you know, there's so many young players these days. They want to stand out. They have got egos, and they're kind of fed up of being stuck in the background. Well, I always say to them, well, if that's the case, why did you pick the bass? It's kind of, I think, you know, if you wanted to be a more flamboyant soloistic player, then perhaps the bass wasn't the best choice for you in the first place. But you know, I love what he said about even if what you play is not complex and you're not drawing attention to yourself and it's not sort of, it doesn't require Olympian sort of technique, you know, you are still valid as an artist. You are still a creative artist, even if you don't. And I think that's such a great thing.
It's so much deeper than that as well, because in many ways that's the surface level of stuff, and being a musician, I'm sure you'd agree, is really about everything else. It's like all the kind of personable stuff that you've spoken about, the creative, the collaborative, and your place in that is a part of the whole. And like you say, if you can just quiet that ego a little bit, it's a lot more successful.
Yes,
you know?
Well, exactly that. Because, I mean, for instance, if we're playing with someone like Eric Clapton, now, obviously, most of the time, it's going to be blues orientated. Now, you know, it's a fairly rigid form, you know, the blues. I mean, there are some variations on it, but it's pretty, it's a standard thing. Now, for instance, I wouldn't necessarily have to play every single sort of notes that was on the original recording of the bass, especially if it's a walking bass line, because walking bass lines can be a bit random, they can be arbitrary. It's only certain songs that have very, very specific bass lines. But if it's like a walking line, I mean, that does give me you know, a certain amount of freedom. But, you know, you have to still remember the genre of music you're playing in, and you still have to play accordingly, whether it's a volume thing, whether it's the tone of your instrument, you know, the attack that you're using. There's a lot of things to think about. So even if you're not being able to be hugely creative and hugely flamboyant, there's a lot of things that you can do. There's a lot more subtle things you can do to still be a creative musicians, you know, like I said, you know, dynamics, you know, the whether you're playing with your fingers or your thumb or a pick, or the area of the instrument you play. There's and this is, you know, Anthony said, you know, his main criteria for whatever project he does is to bring as much intensity to the role as possible, but without stepping out the boundaries, without sort of going too crazy, but do whatever you can do to enhance.
I get that. Yeah. What do you say that? Would you be able to unpack that a little bit more about what he means by intensity?
Yeah. Well, I think he's, you know, for me, what he's saying, I mean, he's a very passionate musician. I mean, you watch Anthony play, and he's actually like watching an orchestral musician. I mean, considering he plays like a bass guitar, you know, you watch the way you can just see the way he performs. It's like watching someone who's playing in a symphony orchestra. He's very, you know, he's not playing like a regular bass guitarist would play. Well, for a start, he plays sitting down, actually. He never plays standing up. But it's just the smaller things that he does. It's just the finer thing. I mean, for instance, you know, he's not afraid. When he's playing this very high-octane fusion music, particularly with Hiromi, you know, he's not afraid just to hold like notes for like several bars. You know, he's a real sustain freak. He loves, you know, sustain on instruments. He loves, and so, you know, for anyone else to have the confidence when everyone else around you is playing this kind of crazy frantic music, just to play like two or four bars where you hold one note and you sustain that the time. But it's just the way he does it, and the way he touches the string with the, you know, there's so much thought that goes into something simple like plucking that one note. You can actually watch him. You can see the way his fingers are poised over the instrument, and you can see he's very deliberate. You know, he's not just hitting that note thinking, oh God, I'm hitting a low F, I've just got to sustain this darn thing as long as I can. He's thinking much deeper than that. You know, he's thinking exactly the lightness of touch, the intensity of it. Is he going to give a little bit of vibrato with his left hand? You know, how long, you know, it's just, he's a real sort of deep thinker, Anthony. That's the reason why he's one of my favorite musicians. He's very, very sort of deep. In fact, when you talk to him, it's kind of quite interesting, because he's like one of these kind of wise Tibetan men that lives at the top of the mountain. You know, when you climb to the top of the mountain, you've got three questions to ask. You've got three key questions. So whenever you meet Anthony, you've got to think of that. You can't go up to him and just say, well, how's the weather? What do you think of the weather? And where have you been on your holidays? Because he's such an intense guy that you need to ask him something of really great value or great worth, because it's just, you know, he's not really going to be that interested in it, you know. So you have to be very careful when you talk to him. But this comes out in his performance. You know, he's very intense, and he's always listening. You can see him on stage. He's always watching the other musicians he's with. And I know a lot of players that don't do that. They actually play and they stare at the floor all night, which to me is not great, because communication on stage is very important.
Yeah.
It's one of the most important things that there is. You know, I mean, okay, you're communicating with each other musically, but it's still important to engage with each other visually, I think. And he does that a lot, but
Well, there's almost no separation, right, at times, or most of the time, really, don't you think, between the musicality and the...
Yeah, very much so. And the thing is, you know, I've been to a few seminars, like sort of music things. I've been to a lot of, you know, of these sort of summer schools and jazz courses. I've just been in the background of a classroom watching what's going on. And there's a famous jazz American double bass player called Red Mitchell. And I've seen a couple of his lectures, sadly no longer with us, but, you know, his key thing was communication. That's what he always taught that was his big thing. You know, didn't go on about technique or soloing. It was all to do with communication. And I thought that was such a key thing, because at the end of the day, that is what it's all about. It's, I mean, yeah, you've got to communicate with each other as performing musicians, but you know, you're communicating with the audience as well. I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, you don't want to sort of disorientate yourself from the audience. I mean, that's often who you're playing to. So you know, he talked an awful lot about that. But yeah, like I said, there's certain musicians that I admire, that there's so much more to them. A lot of people just see them on a very surface level. They say, oh God, he plays really fast. He plays technically advanced music. But I always look for the smaller things, the finite things, the smaller points, because they're the things that interest me. So, you know, I'm looking at, you know, someone's hand positions. And like I said, the way they attack a note, you know, how long they hold the notes on for, you know, all these smaller things, they fascinate me a lot more. And that's the reason why, like now, in my own playing, I've been trying to strip away lots of things in my own playing. And Jules has helped me with that, actually, because all the time he told me to play things simpler. And just simply, you know, play less notes. And at first of all, I thought to myself, oh God, this isn't, because I always wanted to put loads of stuff in there, because I wanted to play like my favorite players, you know, like people like Jaco Pastorius. I wanted to put loads and loads of stuff in there. But I realized, first of all, it didn't fit the music. It was completely incongruous. But I don't know. And here's an interesting thing. One of my favorite double bass players was a guy called Scott LaFaro. And he famously played with Bill Evans. And Scott LaFaro was an incredible player. He was formerly a saxophone player and then was switched to bass. And he rewrote the rules of jazz bass playing, because he became an incredible soloist. You listen to those classic recordings with Bill Evans, and it's incredible what he was playing. It was just no one else was doing it at the time. And when I was younger, I was a complete Scott LaFaro nut, and I would try and play like him and transcribe his stuff. And actually, I even contributed to a book about Scott LaFaro, because sadly, he got killed in a car crash when he was 25. And his bass got damaged, but it was restored. And I got to play his bass about 10 years ago. And then his sister contacted me and said, I'm doing a book about my brother. Would you like to write a few paragraphs? And for me, it was such a great honour to do this. And the book's actually called Jade Visions, The Life and Music of Scott LaFaro. And it was such a proud moment for me to be able to contribute something to the book about one of my musical heroes. But here's the thing, as I've gotten older, I gravitated to players that played a whole lot less, that were much more, I don't know, kind of, yeah, that just played. I mean, Scott really was, I mean, he was a very creative player, played great notes, but there was a lot of technique there. So a lot of the players that I then gravitated towards now, like say Charlie Hayden is another double bass player that we recently lost. And Charlie, they were best friends. In fact, they used to practice together. They used to live together and practice together, but they couldn't be more opposite in their styles. Like Charlie is very deliberate with his playing, very simple. For him, it's much more about the sound of the instrument. He's very careful with his note choices, like Anthony Jackson, the same thing. So these are the people that I'm more drawn to now, the people that are more, I don't know, that have stripped a lot of stuff away, and they're looking at the finer nuances of playing, of tone production, of sound, whatever. And a lot of that came from Jules. I think it was Jules telling me to keep things simple and to play a whole lot less. And it made me realize the value of doing that, because a lot of the time it was better for the music. It was better for the artists I was working with, that I wasn't trying to be, you know, have a huge ego and try and be, to play complex and solos all the time. It was a great thing for me to learn. So yeah, I play a whole lot less now.
Yeah. Dave, I mean, we should probably wrap up soon, because we're getting on to kind of well over an hour almost now, which is great. It's been awesome. It's been awesome chatting and hearing about stuff. I got a few kind of quick questions just to round stuff off. I mean, clearly you've played with a number of people who most people have heard of.
Yeah.
Quite a few.
Sure.
Is there anyone that you haven't played with that I'm sure there is, but you know, who, if you could pick maybe one or two people who you haven't played with that you'd still like to play
well,
with,
you know, pretty,
who would they be?
Yeah, well, I always say the same one actually, and I come, it's Stevie Wonder.
Yeah.
because I love Stevie Wonder's music. I grew up on it. It's just fabulous. He's an incredible artist. I've seen him play a number of times now. And yes, if I could have Stevie Wonder on my CV, I would have been thrilled. I'd love to play with Joni Mitchell as well. Joni Mitchell would have been very cool.
Great. And if you could only give one piece of advice to a young musician starting out now, what would it be?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I've been asked this before, but, you know, I think, forgive me if I've already mentioned this, but, you know, my dad didn't give me a great deal of advice because, you know, not because he didn't want to. He was just a very quiet, private guy. But my dad said to me when I was younger, he said, listen more than you speak. And interestingly, this jazz guitarist friend of mine said, listen more than you play. You know, and I think that's a key thing. I think that, you know, that's probably the best. Well, actually, the other great piece of advice I've been given, and it's what we've all heard, is always attempt to play with musicians better than yourself, more accomplished than yourself, because that will help you more than anything else. Because again, I've learned more lessons from being on the bandstand than any classroom. And the best lessons I've learned are from playing with musicians that were older than me. When I started out, I was always the youngest one in the band. The other guys in the band were a lot older than me, and there was always something to learn from them. So, I think, for younger players, I would say always strive to play with musicians better than yourself and more accomplished, because you will rise to the situation, and you'll have to. If you're playing with those guys, you won't have any choice. But that's what I've learned most of my lessons have been by doing that, really.
And lastly, we know that you're off on tour in a bit, but what else is going on in your professional life and stuff like that at the moment? What's going on?
Well, the thing is, I'm actually getting back into playing my trombone, which I'm really excited about, because I always said to myself that I would come back to it. So I'm having a lot of fun now playing it all over again, because I'm playing it in a very different way. So before I was so caught up with reading music. So now I'm, because of what I've learned from the bass, I'm actually transferring that to the trombone now. So, you know, because my ears are better, my ability to improvise. So it's really weird. It's kind of quite exciting going back to it after all these years.
Sounds like coming full circle.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's fun. And at the moment, I'm just doing it for fun. But having said that, if I do get my chops back, then I would consider using it on gigs. I'd happily do that. I think it'd be a lot of fun. But our summer tour with Jules is just ending, and we're just about to start a whole new series of Jules' Radio 2 shows. They start next week. I don't know who the guests are yet, but they're always very varied and fun. So that's coming up. And I mean, obviously, I did this project with our mutual friend, Thomas Solomon Gray, which is an album I did with Tom called New Beginnings last year, with some fantastic other musicians like Mike Outram on guitar, Mike Outram on guitar, Ivo Neem on piano, and Dave Story on drums. And that was fantastic to do. And I think we're going to be doing some gigs with that lineup. Songs from that album. So, there's a couple of things. But at the end of the day, the Jules gig, I guess it's my day job, which I still call it that.
Or night job.
Yeah, night job indeed. But so there's plenty to keep me occupied.
Yeah, fantastic. And where can people find out more about you?
Well, I do have my own website, which is just very simply daveswiftbass.com. It's a brand new website that I've got. So that's one place they can find out an awful lot and contact me through there. I am actually on Facebook too, but I'm not on Facebook as it's not as a musician or a band. I'm actually just on Facebook as Dave Swift. So I'm very accessible on there.
Good stuff. Wicked, Dave. Well, listen, thanks so much for coming on. It's been spectacular chatting. Have a good rest of your day, man.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.